Hello, and welcome to another episode of the IEA podcast. I'm Emily Carver. Don't forget to subscribe. We're available on Podbean, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. You can catch up on all our latest video content on our YouTube channel. We've started posting a new video there every day of the week. And make sure you check out our new IEA Daily Bulletin for our latest commentary, videos, and expert analysis. You can register on the IEA website. Just follow the link on our homepage. Throughout this crisis, the country has been encouraged to pay tribute not only to the doctors, nurses, and social care workers out on the front line, but also to the idea and the institution of the National Health Service itself. The status of the NHS in politics is not a unique side effect of the current pandemic, but a regular feature in politics. The NHS has become a resilient populist cause for those on the left and the right, with allegations about funding, historical decisions, and conspiracy. This makes having a grown-up conversation about the case for reform near impossible. But is NHS populism good for those working in the NHS, let alone the patients? And is it sustainable for the government to demand uncritical adulation towards NHS staff, when countless others in the private sector face a very uncertain future? Today I'm joined by Andy Mayer, Chief Operating Officer at the IEA. Hi Andy, thanks for joining me again.
Hi Emily, good to be back.
Excellent. So you've recently written an article for the IEA blog entitled NHS Workers Should Be Wary of NHS Populism. Could you start by explaining a bit about what you mean by NHS populism?
Well, let's start with populism itself, because it's a somewhat poisonous word in politics and it's usually used as a pejorative. But in reality, all it means is a political approach designed to appeal to ordinary people, whatever ordinary people means. And it's usually said in the context of a conflict, such as with an elite group, whatever elite means, who specifically disregard the concerns of ordinary people. So if we look at in the context of NHS populism, ordinary people there are patients, they're friends and relatives, any of us who might be those things one day, and everybody working in healthcare services. So pretty much everyone. And it's a real 99% argument. It's not quite so clear who the elites are in the NHS populist model and whose concerns are they disregarding and do they really exist? But if we try to simplify the question, we look at NHS populism in two clear strands. And on one side, there's left-wing NHS populism. And in that strand, there's never enough money. The NHS is in a permanent crisis at all times, and it's got to be saved. It's got to be saved from unseen elite enemies who usually are capitalists, people who want to privatise the NHS, and often the ultimate bogeyman, which is the American corporations that presumably want to do this. And sometimes people throw in Donald Trump there at the moment, but previously they threw in Ronald Reagan or George Bush. And it's seen as it's a real campaign about the other, this quite scary group, quite a conspiratorial approach that exists out there somewhere and threatens the NHS. Now, if you ever criticise the NHS on Twitter, you will see this. You will assuredly see a number of people come back at you, accusing you of having a very hidden agenda and really that you want to deprive the poor of treatment or harm children. So that's where left-wing populism sits. On the right-wing, or more accurately, conservative NHS populism, this is really about venerating the institution. Now, the left do this as well, but the left are not a homogenous socialist blob. They're also a group that celebrates faith, flag and family, for example, the Blue Labour movement. And this institutional populism is very much about how good the NHS is in itself. It's our NHS, our being the operative word. Now, in that regard, it's very much like the attitude of the Conservative Party to the Church of England in the 20th century. Or say metropolitan liberals to the BBC at the current time, or traditional Labour to the union movement. In this version of populism, to criticise the institution is unpatriotic, it's damaging to the social order, and just deeply unwise. And this has been known for some time. If you go back 20 years, you'll note that the Conservative Party in particular had a lot of vulnerability to being attacked about their attitude towards the NHS. They're really vulnerable in the Blair and Major years about their desire to reform it, and reform was seen as a dirty word. So they looked at that and thought, well, actually, okay, we'll make that our own. And you see this in the 2010 election. So David Cameron, as part of his modernisation agenda, experiments with the slogan, the party of the NHS. his successors, and obviously himself in 2015, did it again, 2017, 2019. You can see a version of it in the 2011 AV referendum. So you may or may not remember a poster which was generally attacking Nick Clegg, but saying she needs a maternity ward, not an alternative voting system. And everybody knows the 2016 EU referendum example, which is let's give our NHS the £350 million the EU takes every week. And without going into detail of each of those campaigns, what the strategists have done there is look at the quite satirical conceit that the NHS is the religion of the British people and said, yes, yes, it is. That is precisely what it is. And you know what? That's going to be our thing now. It's going to be an institutional state religion and we're going to take it back. And that's worked. Johnson's government in 2019 was more trusted with the NHS in opinion polls than Labour. And historically, that's quite astonishing. And it would be quite unwise of anybody who seeks to reform or change the NHS to be unaware of that hard evidence of political success on the back of ignoring the reform agenda.
Of course, those of us in favour of reform are wary of this kind of rhetoric and this political narrative. But why should NHS workers themselves be concerned by this?
Well, it seems quite counterintuitive, doesn't it? Because surely if there's a national consensus that the NHS is above reproach and underfunded, it's taking both the right and left view, NHS workers should be able to look forward to a bright future of ever higher rewards, all the resources they need to do their jobs, and adulation to go with it. But that's not necessarily the real situation, nor even if it were briefly the situation, is it sustainable? So one problem is this. If you work for a venerated institution that's above reproach, that includes reproach for concerns you might have about how the service is being run from the inside. So the media and public will take seriously a complaint of poor practice or dangerous behaviour when it comes from a medical or hospital worker. However, it's fairly evident in recent years that the institution itself does not. There have been a number of whistleblowing scandals in the NHS where staff trying to do the right thing have been treated appallingly. So, for example, this led to the mid-staff scandal in 2005-09, where between 400 and 1200 patients may have died as a result of negligence and a culture of fear and bullying that discouraged whistleblowing. It allowed the Alder Hey scandal, the illegal harvesting of over 105,000 organs from dead children throughout the 1990s. And last decade, there was the Chris Day case where he complained about under-resourcing and his employer, Health Education England, threw him to the wolves. I mean, we've got a nice quote from the head of the whistleblowing charity Protect, which said at the time, there is something about whistleblowing, that sense that you're doing what's right in the healthcare situation, and then suddenly everyone turns on you and you're the bad guy. And what's really bad about that is it's an entirely predictable side effect of venerating institutions. So we saw this in the church over child abuse scandals, and we saw that extended to both the BBC and the NHS in the case of Jimmy Savile. An overly protective attitude to the system endangers the individuals within it, both the patients and the workers. Second problem, which is related, is this is dehumanising. There are really two different NHSs. There's the real NHS, which is an administrative vehicle for prioritising, organising, delivering healthcare through state and non-state providers, employs around 2% of the UK population, consumes about 20% of government spending and about 10% of GDP. Good at some things, bad at others, and it manages to be relatively cost-effective by rationing care as opposed to necessarily being more productive. And then there's the idea, which you mentioned right in the opening, or the ideal of the NHS, which is about delivering the best health care in the world instantly and consistently in every therapeutic discipline for free, staffed by angels and heroes. And that ideal has never been real, and nor is it achievable. No healthcare system in one country is going to be the best at everything everywhere, nor does change and improvement happen fast by central planning or instantly. So the angels and heroes themselves, going right back to your original question about why NHS workers should be concerned, are being treated as objects in this model. They're objects of a state institution. With that comes very unrealistic expectations of what they can and can't do. And when they don't meet those expectations, which inevitably they will not, that amplifies hostility towards them and it amplifies the institution's desire to cover up and protect itself. And there are other issues as well, but we'll come to those as we progress.
But has not the UK's veneration of the NHS, as you put it, in fact been a positive thing in this crisis? I mean, you've seen the line, protect the NHS. Has that not encouraged people to obey lockdown restrictions and thereby prevent unnecessary deaths?
Okay, so, I mean, we don't yet know how successful or not the government's been at preventing unnecessary deaths, and obviously that's the goal. And the goal of the line is a good one, which is to try and do that. And if I look out my window right now, I can see a rainbow in the opposite window above an NHS logo. above a ledge full of teddy bears. Now, that's lovely. That's really beautiful. I mean, these people, everybody's trying to do the right thing, and everybody's trying to protect healthcare workers. And they should. I mean, in a crisis where we are all dependent on the healthcare system to protect us from an unknown virus, or rather one we don't know well enough yet, they are the front line. Clearly, you need to protect them and make sure that they have the right equipment to do their jobs. But this isn't really a government campaign. I mean, where this comes from is a spontaneous reaction of people starting in Italy. So there, during the lockdown, people stood on their balconies and spontaneously started cheering for health workers and those on the front line out of respect, out of love. And that's great. I mean, that's a really good thing, and that should be encouraged. But I think what the government's failed to recognise here is the difference between what works in an election campaign, which is the use of the NHS as a slogan, and the reality of the NHS, which is the people in it. If it's the people you're trying to protect, then say so. It's not the institution. That's a political debate that's for another time.
You've mentioned in our conversation that the NHS has an almost religious status in this country, which makes it, well, you know, very hard, indeed sometimes impossible, to have a straightforward discussion over the potential merits of reform. Is this a relatively new situation? Has this always been the case? Has it always been that people, that there's an inertia with the NHS, that we can't have these discussions over reform? And are all politicians as guilty as each other for continuing to further this populist political narrative around the NHS that you describe?
If we look at the fundamentals of it, so I've already talked about the way the Conservative strategists reacted to what was perceived as complete domination by the Labour Party of the healthcare issue throughout the Blair and Brown years. Before that, yes, there were debates about the health system, and it has had a role in most elections. And if you go right back to the foundation of the NHS itself, there were big debates about whether it should come in. So there's a lot of scepticism about whether it was the right thing to do at the time, whether or not replacing all these voluntary organisations and mutual systems was a good thing. So whether politicians are guilty about for discussing this, I don't think is the right question, because in reality, it's a political issue. Whether healthcare systems are mostly private, mostly public, people want to talk about it. What's different here is this insistence that it's a issue that's almost above debate when it comes to the NHS. So in other countries, and I think Christian Niemitz, leading expert on this subject, discussed this quite well in the preamble to his 2017 publication. He says in Germany, where he grew up, they have arguably a better healthcare system, not universally so, but in many respects, something that we aspire to. And the difference, he said, was that we were able to talk about healthcare, criticise the system, say other countries do it better than we do, look at different areas and say we can improve here. But in this country, we can't.
I mean, we've seen in recent days and weeks that there has been a little more of a conversation. We have been looking at comparisons with other healthcare systems, not just the US. This has sort of historically been the main obstacle to a sensible discussion, as you mentioned. But now mainstream journalists are beginning to talk about the alternatives a little bit more. Would you agree? We've seen even those on the far left of politics commenting on how the German system, for example, has dealt better with this crisis. Do you think that maybe this pandemic might just be the catalyst we need to spark a more grown-up conversation on how the NHS is funded and structured?
Well, I'd love to believe that was true, but I think in reality, the journalists and politicians currently are seeing what they want to see. Mm-hmm. So when the left is talking about Germany, it's saying, well, comparatively, we are underfunded. I mean, oddly, they never look at the US and say, comparatively, we are underfunded, despite the US spending about 15% of GDP on healthcare, because that system is their bogeyman and they don't want to change that. But in the German system, what we think is quite important is the decentralization. The fact there are different providers, some state, some non-state, they compete with each other, they make mistakes, they learn from each other's mistakes and improve on each other, and it's a more resilient system. I'm not convinced that's what people are seeing who happen to think that the NHS should just be improved in the way it is now.
I mean, as you say, I mean, with the rainbows and things, we've seen an outpouring of support for the NHS and its workers in recent weeks. You say, however, in your article that there's a real risk people working in the private sector will become resentful of NHS staff who are, on the whole, generously paid and in largely guaranteed secured jobs. You note, for example, that the average salaries in the NHS are some 20% above the national average. Do you think the government and NHS staff unions have focused too much on demanding people praise the NHS and its staff at the expense of fostering solidarity with the public? What do you believe has gone wrong here?
Well, I think the solidarity point is a crucial one. So the campaign Clap for Carers, the government to protect the NHS slogan, these are about asking the public to show solidarity with healthcare workers at this time of crisis. Well, solidarity is a two-way street. It cuts both ways. And NHS workers equally need to be aware about the worries and concerns that are going on in people's lives, you know, people who are losing their jobs, people who don't know if their businesses are coming back when the lockdown is lifted. And I think there's a danger of short-term memories going on, particularly with the staff unions. I mean, we only have to go back to 2016 and the BMA junior doctors strike to see a strike that failed, and it failed because they fundamentally didn't understand how they were perceived. In their minds, they were underpaid, working far too long hours in bad conditions, and that was something that needed to be addressed and fundamentally addressed with higher pay. What the public saw was a group of people who, at that time in their careers, may not have been as well paid as some of their senior peers, but then who is? And when you start your career, you are paid less. But your chance for a really good salary in the long term is huge. I mean, if you're a hospital doctor working in the NHS at a senior level, you can be earning a six-figure salary. And not only that, you can top it up with private practice. So they didn't get the public there. They didn't see themselves as the public saw them, which was, while admired and valued, also people who were paid a really decent wage, and certainly compared to them, certainly if you include things like the benefits and the pensions. So it would be a mistake to come out of this crisis where, if we look at the initial figures, potentially 13 to 15% of the economy may be missing, and say, well, right now the absolute priority is we reward NHS workers by giving them a massive pay rise as a big thank you from all of us to you. I mean, maybe pay rise should be down the road, but we've got to get the economy back into gear first in order to ensure that that can actually be funded. And if they go too early on that, they're going to cause real resentment. They're going to create the situation that populism is designed to address, which is of an elite who are disregarding the needs and concerns of ordinary people.
Thank you, Andy. That was really great. Thank you for joining me today. Let's hope the narrative does begin to change as we come out of this crisis. If you would like to read more about the case for reform of the NHS, do head online to our website, iea.org.uk, where we have a number of publications on the subject. And also we have lots of other podcasts on the subject as well. So do catch up on previous episodes. That was Andy Mayer, our Chief Operating Officer at the IEA. Thank you.
Thank you, Emily.